to the Super League Triathlon podcast and this face-to-face episode. Face-to-face is where I, Adam Leach from Super League Triathlon, get the great privilege of sitting down with some of the great and the good from our sport and trying to get to know them a bit better with some no-holds-barred long-form interviews. It's really been an interesting experience doing this. I'm really enjoying it. And I'm hoping that people are getting something out of it and getting to know these athletes a little bit better and hear some new insights on them that's not just the stories that we're all very familiar with. My guest for this episode, I'm really pleased to say, was none other than Lauren Steadman. Lauren is well known as not only really a trailblazer for para triathlon and a great advocate for para sport in general, but also in the UK has a huge profile, having been on reality TV shows, including Strictly Come Dancing, which is probably the biggest, most watched TV show in the UK, and obviously circulates worldwide as well. It's given her an incredible platform that she really tries to use very positively. So we talked a lot about her life, her career, growing up with disability and how she's turned that into such a positive in her life. And Lauren strikes me, she's very composed, but she strikes me as kind of a bit of a restless soul, I think, in that she's always looking for the next challenge in life. She's always looking for the next mountain to conquer, as it were. And we talk a lot about in the podcast about sort of that psychology and why it's there in her, and also about what those next challenges are. I mean, they are remarkable. I kind of don't want to drop in any spoilers, but she is taking on a couple of monumental challenges alongside everything else that she's up to, which yeah, she's quite something. She's a bit of a force of nature. But anyway, I really hope you enjoy this episode and this interview with Lauren. It'd be great if you could subscribe to listen to more of Face to Face and the Super League Triathlon podcast with Will McCloy and his brilliant guests. Like us, subscribe, review, whatever you do, it would be great. Listen in for whenever the next one comes. But I really hope in the meantime you enjoy this interview with Lauren Steadman. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us for this long form interview for our new face to face series with Super League Triathlon. It's really lovely to welcome you here for this. I guess to start with, it's just interesting to hear your reflections just on your life in general. You've had such an incredible life. Your story is amazing, from your childhood through your incredible athletic career, all the things you've now done outside of sport as well. I mean, do you allow yourself a little bit of time to ever reflect on this incredible journey that you've had?
Well, thank you. I actually don't stop very well. And when I'm doing nothing, I feel like something's wrong. I go into panic mode. I'm like, there's something I should be doing. Like, I'm working towards something. I think since being a little girl, I've just had this massive passion for life and this want to... I think I've got a fear of not doing everything that's possible. Like, we're only here for a small number of years, and I would hate to be super, super old and think, oh, if only I'd done that. So I feel as though I've got this huge bucket list of things to do within sport, out of sport. And I just always have this vision that I tell everybody, like, I'm 70 years old on a veranda, hopefully in Italy somewhere, with my wine and my olives. And maybe I've got this really nice looking husband next to me, and I'm like, gosh, look, what a life I live. Like, I couldn't have fit any more into it than I have done. And within sport, I'm very much love that the journey of, you know, you have those individual moments where you are racing, and they're the ones that I guess people remember, the moments that you treasure. But actually, all of those days, you know, 18 years as an elite athlete so far in my life, like, it's a journey. And if I look back at that young girl that you mentioned, did she ever dream of going to 4 Paralympics, becoming Paralympic champion, then doing the TV shows and the academics? I don't think so. And I don't think we can predict the way that our life goes. But I think that every time we get given an opportunity or some doors, whichever choice you make, literally sets a new path for your life. And I think when I've been given the opportunities, I've made smart decisions. Some of them you could argue, well, that could have put off towards your sporting goals. But actually, I think I knew my capabilities and I knew that actually I could achieve all these things. I just had to be smart. So when I reflect on it, I have a wall actually. It's kind of growing and I didn't realize that I've got a wall, but it's got like me with the gold. It's got the MBE. It's got me graduating. It's got my family. It's got Strictly Pictures, SAS. And I want to keep grabbing those great moments and I never want to stop pushing myself to be the best version I can be.
That's really interesting. I mean, you were obviously born without your lower right arm. Is that, do you feel like you see that mentality you've described in a lot of able-bodied people, or do you think that you kind of developed that as kind of a mechanism to drive you forward when you were younger?
I think it's a really interesting question as to whether having a disability has made my mindset. Someone once said to me, if you had two hands, do you think you would have gone to the Olympics? So it's really interesting, and I'm not quite sure. I know my personality is one of hunger and is one of wanting to not prove to others, but prove to myself that, you know, there is a limit here, but you need to push your limits. I think that having one arm, and I always credit this to my parents, and me and my sister have very, very similar in how much we want to achieve and strive for things. So therefore, that must come down to our, you know, our upbringing, our parents. But my mum said when I was younger, having a child anyway, you want to, you know, give them the opportunities, push them to be the best. But she said, when you have a child, you also want to protect them. But she said, if I had protected you, overprotected you because you have a disability as a youngster, that would have made you shy away from opportunities or rely on me. So she used to tell me that I would fall over in the playground. And, you know, other mums are looking like at her to run over and pick me up. You're okay. She's like, I left you. I sort of stayed out of sight. And you knew you couldn't see me, so you would brush your knees off, get up and carry on. And I think that installed in me a sense of independence. They would say stubbornness now, but I go for determined. I'm very determined. And it's gone through my whole life. So when there's barriers, when there's anything, I'm like, right, how can I break this barrier down? How can I push it? But I do think that Paralympians have a different mindset over Olympians or para versus able-bodied. And I think it just comes from a sense of gratitude, of resilience. Some people that have had disabilities have gone through hell. You know, I was born with mine. I don't know any different. I don't like to be boxed. People look at me and I'm pretty sure they're like, well, how's she going to do this? I'm like, well, watch me. and I think, you know, if you've had an accident or something, there's a new lease of life in you to prove that actually you don't need to be all limbs or fully functioning. You can get by and achieve great things with having a disability.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard other Paralympians say something similar, and many of them have said that given a choice of their life, they would choose to live the same life again with a disability. They wouldn't choose any other way. I think that mindset is fascinating and perhaps challenges a lot of people and their preconceptions.
I definitely think so, and I think nobody can really understand. Well, I actually say this quite a lot when I'm speaking to people, is that when you're sat in a room full of 100 people, one of you won't go running because you've got a sore knee.
Mm.
So do you have a disability? Because it doesn't allow you to do what somebody who doesn't have a sore knee does. So in one way, people can relate to if you've got a bad back and it stops you from doing one thing or another. That is simply what a disability is. It's on a daily basis dealing with something that may be limiting factor, or it could be exceptionally painful. You know, it's management. But the biggest thing for me is mindset. And quite often we aren't grateful for what we do have. And I think having a disability reminds you that life is so precious. And I often think to myself, like, if I had had two hands, would I have been given such a beautiful life? Or would I have led such great opportunities? And I think when people do have disabilities and then they've still gone on to achieve great sporting things or anything for that sense in achievements, or have married the one that they love, have had children, like, doesn't define you. A disability definitely doesn't define you. And actually, if more people could embrace the fact that imperfections and having disabilities, you know, it's you, embrace it. You are sassy, you are incredible, just be the best you can be. Your circumstances don't actually affect that. It is your mindset. And if your mindset says you can, then you will find a way to do it.
Well, I must admit, I didn't mean to start off on quite such a deep and meaningful, it's fascinating to hear the way you think, genuinely is. But I kind of wonder if this, like thinking aloud, because of your profile and your success, both from a sporting sense and away from sport, you kind of have almost found yourself, I don't know whether it's by choice or unwittingly, as kind of like almost a spokesperson for certainly for para triathlon,
yep,
and Paralympic sport in general, I would say as well. Is that how you feel about it? Is it something that's just been thrust upon you? And I mean, is it something that you kind of take in your stride? Is it something you relish, or are there times you think, I don't want to speak for everybody?
I think when you are speaking for everybody, you have to be aware that everybody feels different.
Yeah.
So how I feel towards disability could be very different to how somebody else with a disability feels. But what I do know is that I am the happiest when I am boosting other people, encouraging other people. And if, you know, I will talk about it and I will talk about disability, but I'm more of a doer. Mm. So I think my reasonings for pushing limits within triathlon, swimming, with doing Strictly Come Dancing and SAS was more one to prove, Lauren, can you do these? And I ticked a box in my own heart. But also then for anybody at home that had doubts in themselves, please look and watch. Like, I want to help you to believe in yourself. I want you to remove any excuse or doubt you have. And I think having that platform is something that I thoroughly enjoy having, is that I've had just young girls with one, actually myself and Claire, the Claire Cashmore Girl Race. Mm. We are massive in that we want all the kids with one arm to not have to battle some of the things we battled when we were younger. And it's a case of, you guys are incredible. Let's just showcase through what we do that you can do anything. But I think going on Strictly, you know, I wasn't the best dancer by far. I mean, I got really, really far and I tried my best. But each and every week, myself and my dance partner AJ would receive these messages, and we would turn up every week trying to deliver the best dance, but knowing that there were people at home watching. That there was one lady that had lost her arm to meningitis, and she'd never been out, I think she was 70 now, she'd never been out of the house without her prosthesis. And we'd received a letter to say she'd watched me on Strictly Come Dancing with my arm out for everybody to see in front of 14 million people, and she went to Sainsbury's that day without her prosthesis.
Wow.
Like, if that is all I have done by going on one TV show is given that lady the chance to actually have confidence in herself, then great. And you say about, you know, showcasing and speaking for people with disabilities, it's just about having the conversation and normalizing things. So previous to London 2012, it was always when you would talk to young children, they would be sat there just staring at the arm. They haven't been exposed to disability. They don't know how to ask questions, or can they ask questions. Doing London 2012, doing Strictly, all of those things that highlight, you know, having a disability and let's ask me questions. When I now talk to children, they're like, oh, she's got one arm. And the questions are, so what do you eat as an athlete?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you've gone from being that disabled person to, this is an elite athlete with a disability, yeah, but I want to know what she does as an athlete. And that for me is a powerful thing as well, is the normalization of it. And parents, you know, encourage your kids. If you see me down the street, don't be like, oh, don't ask questions. Come. I'll probably feed them a story like, it, you know, a crocodile ate it. But then I'll joke about it. But that's how it should be. It should be, you know, children should be able to come up and ask questions for any disability. And most Paralympians will be there like, yeah, of course, let me tell you. So I love the fact that I am being given the chance to educate, to re-energize and change mindsets of people. Because I do think sometimes we live life in a, can we do this? When it should be actually, let me give it a go.
Yeah, I mean, you just, the energy you give off, you're overwhelmingly positive, which kind of answers my other point, which is like, I wondered if like the pressure sometimes to kind of be somebody, to be somebody that's kind of almost always positive about themselves is kind of almost superhuman in many ways. That's how a lot of people would view it. Whether that pressure ever weighs on you?
I think, as with everybody, I have my own self-doubts. I've conquered them. I've gone through them. I mean, my athletic career within paratriathlon has looked very very successful, in which, you know, 3 world titles, 7 European, took the Paralympic title. But I had a swimming career before, mm-hmm. and gave exactly the same energy to swimming as I did triathlon, and could just never quite get there. Like, for 5 years, was on 1:06 for 100 meters freestyle, literally every single race. And I would race that maybe 20, 30 times a year. And the self-doubt was there, the tears, the pain of wanting to achieve something that I was training. And in training, I was hitting the time. So why wasn't it happening? And I think everything we go through in life, we have to learn to embrace. So all of those times that we could class them as failures, and that's the word that most people use, but it's, I don't like that word. But as long as you take something from it, you reframe it, or you learn, and then when you next approach something that's tough, you don't make the same mistakes, or you don't allow those demons to get you, it's no longer a failure. It's just a learning curve. So I would like to think that there is that me constantly being switched on, but I went through a period that made me learn to look at things in a different light, to adjust my angles, and I have a different approach to triathlon now, which is, why do you do it in the first place, Lauren? Performance isn't my first goal, is happiness, and seeking the fact that, you know, I'm doing this because, and I have to do it every day, so I don't want to be sad every day, or you know, oh, I've got to train today. It should be, I'm training today because I really enjoy this. I enjoy pushing myself, and I want to be a better version. But I think these things are hard to learn. Do I have doubtful moments? Yes. How do I conquer those? I go back to what makes me really happy outside of sport: family time, dancing. I'll still go dance salsa. Do something that's that switches you off completely from whatever is getting to you. And I think people need to also put that, whether you're an athlete or whether you are just general population, just learn that actually putting in your diary me time for a weekend, that reset is huge. And I had to learn that the hard way. I didn't do that very well. So everything I am today, I have learned. And do I switch off? Does the pressure get to me? Yes, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
So you talked about that kind of learning process. I take it that was around the sort of your swimming career there that you were talking about. You touched on, you played it down there, but you were an incredible swimmer before you moved to triathlon, absolute elite level swimmer. But obviously you couldn't quite get the little extra bit out of yourself. When you look back now, was that ability, or was that in your mind?
I think it was a mixture. As a swimmer, I was actually talking with Grace Norman yesterday, when, because obviously London Pool for me is very special. So coming here for League, like, I walk in and I'm like, oh, I love this place. So my arm speed was never quite fast enough for the 100, but that was my favorite. Like, it's an in and out, it's everything you've got. And then the 400, I'm quite leg dominant when I swim. And we race girls with two arms, and I could never quite get where I needed to in the 400, even though I was suited to the longer stuff, which hence in triathlon doing the 750 is better for me. I gave too much. When I was younger, I was 110%. So that was nutrition, sleeping, everything that's asked of you as an athlete, but I forgot to switch off. I forgot to go to the cinemas with friends. I forgot to have the extra family time that was needed. And I think learning to dance salsa when I got to university gave me that break away from it. And I got a bit more of a balance. None of my friends currently are sporty. So when...
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
When I finish training, I literally hang the bike, shoes up, anything, and the conversation is no longer sport.
That's always great in life. Right? And when you meet people who don't ask you about the thing that everybody else asks you about and that consumes the rest of your life.
Exactly. And I think it's something that's missed quite often is, like, even if you're just, say, a corporate person at work, you're going into a business building, but they are your circle of friends. And then you're going to go and you're going to continue talking about work because it just naturally happens. Yeah. That's your topic of conversation. So I learned, actually, let's, I guess, compartmentalize, segment my life. So that happened. And I think there was a turning point in paratriathlon, that simple phrase of control the controllables. I used to get exceptionally worked up on, you know, what are the other girls doing? But you really cannot control that. You cannot control the course, the weather, the girls. And learning that fact, and learning that as long as you have controlled what you can on the day, there is nothing else that can happen. So in Tokyo, I was as cool as a cucumber, and I've never felt like that. And I was a bit concerned, because you should be a little bit, oh, this is the Paralympics and I'm trying to get gold and I'm afraid. But I had given everything I possibly could in training. I was in the best shape I could be. I knew the course. Everything I could prepare was prepared. So actually, if I had brought home a silver medal or a bronze medal, I'd have been so happy, for the one reason of I would have delivered everything I could have to get to that point, and on the day would have executed the best I could. You cannot ask for any more than that. I could beat myself up, but what if this happens? What if that? Well, I can't control any of that. What I can control is my decisions in the moment. And I had to learn that swimming the wrong way at Rio. Like, that was on no one else, that was on me. Like, I had to deal with that, and I was resentful to triathlon, to the whole world after that. But at the same time, I look back at it now, and if I had taken the gold in Rio, maybe I would have retired, and then I wouldn't have got the gold in Tokyo. I wouldn't have got the opportunity to be on Strictly. All these other things that fall in place because of something. So I have no regrets. I am sat here as the version of Lauren Stebbins today because of those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible career that you've had athletically. But I guess as a result came these opportunities to do things. You mentioned Celebrity SES. You mentioned Strictly Come Dancing. I wonder how challenging those were as concepts when they were first presented to you. As, do you want to go and do this? And I don't mean perhaps the physical act of getting through those shows, though obviously there is a considerable physical act involved in both of them. But kind of the mentality to sort of step outside of the world of elite athlete into kind of a world of celebrity.
It was very interesting to learn that there are worlds outside of sport. I think that was the one that I learned the most was, and actually lately, George Peasgood, with his accident, George said something very similar to me, is perspective. And I think this is everything that we forget, is we are consumed and think that everyone loves triathlon around the world. And actually only the other day I had an appointment with someone, and she went, where are the next Paralympics or the Olympics? And I was like, how do you not even know this? Like, it's like, but that's because it's our world. Like, yeah, we are consumed with these dates, with these places. But obviously there's millions of people, and there are other things that are important to them. So stepping into the world of Strictly and realizing, wow, there's a whole world of television, and it is huge, and it's the most important thing to these people. And then doing SES and realizing and having ultimate respect for special forces and military, but there's a whole military world out there. There's thousands of people. So it was lovely to step out and realize there is more to life than just triathlon and sport. And I learned that if I wish to change paths, that was an opportunity. There was copious things I could do. And I have, if you ask me to do a triathlon in front of 14 million people on live national television, fine. Asking me to do a cha-cha-cha or a paso doble in front of 40 million people put me outside my comfort zone. I was really like, oh no. And AJ said to me, he was like, you go really quiet just before we do it. And I'm like, I think that's the triathlon thing, where you're going through your mind and how you're going to race this, what you're going to do. And I was like, yep, I'm just trying to remember all the steps and which camera to look at and how to act. So it did push my zones. But in a great way. First, it was daunting and it was a bit scary. But you apply what you know as an athlete, and you know, you're going through the training room. And I was probably a bit too serious in the training room, because I'm like, well, this is training, like, you know, to get it right, everything's got to be perfect. So I learned to, I guess, let go a little bit. I learned to, as an athlete, we are so like, this is our race face. Mm. Don't look at me. You look at me, I'm gonna beat you. As in the race, not actually beat you.
Oh, that's good. I was getting nervous. I was like, I'm not sure. I thought the interview was going quite well, but then Lauren punched me. Yeah. Obviously not.
But then they're like, oh, you need to smile, look at the camera. And at one point I was like, if you could cry at this point, that would be great. I was like, I can't cry on cue. Like, I've really tried. Like, if I stare at something long enough, maybe my eyes will water. So it was a completely different world, and that really challenged me. But SAS, Who Dares Wins, was, I'm going to say, an easier one, because I'm used to being in a dark place physically. I'm used to not giving out much. I'm used to being, so any of us triathletes, like, it's easier to be in that environment than it is the glitz, the glam, the exposed, you know. So I found SAS you know, easier to, in my mind, conquer the physical, the toughness, and just, you know, it was like blocks of cheese and eggs for dinner and the blandness of food and the lack of sleep. Well, give it to me. Like, I'm used to that.
This is my life.
Like, what do you want from me? And what was challenging there was being partnered with people that didn't quite, I guess, in the world of sport, you keep going until maybe your legs give out and you've got nothing left. And so partnering with people that would give up a lot earlier than you would, that was the bit that really I struggled with. Yeah. But yeah, and I see it as that's another pocket that I've filled there, and I've tried that area there. So yeah, it's just for me, and I guess just new challenges. And where's Lauren Stebbins limits? I need to know that.
But that's an interesting one, because that's also, you touched on the physical there, but I'm really interested in that move to being an athlete, where things come as a result of success in being an athlete, but suddenly you're on these incredible platforms. Like Strictly, what was the most, must be the most popular show in the United Kingdom, and is broadcast around the world as well. Yeah. So there is a moment there where you go from being an athlete who probably gets some recognition to somebody who is almost viewed by the public now as a bona fide celebrity, stopped on the street, recognized all the time, getting on and off a bus or whatever it may be, going in the shops. That's a huge change of mindset and like in your personal being as well.
It is. And sometimes you wonder, is it better to lead a private life? Which sometimes certain circumstances, yes, you want the quiet, no one's around. But actually, being a household name, I have that. I said to you earlier, I want to boost people. I want to make people happy. I want to. That allows me the platform to do so. You know, everything that's put in front of me and people that watch now, I like to think I lead a good and honest life. So I have nothing to hide. So I want these people to join the journey with me. I want them to be on the learning curves. I mean, I still find it quite difficult in that being vulnerable. So if I am going through like a dark training phase or what I'm trying to do, or I'm feeling a little nervous or anxious, is sharing that with people, because it's all well and fine sharing the highs and the positives, but actually, can I be open and honest with you and say, like, I am struggling? And we saw that last year when I said, you know, I needed a bit of a sabbatical from sport because I wasn't enjoying it. And that was tough for me as someone that strives for success and always trying to be the best I can be. Admitting that I was struggling and needing a break was tough. And we've seen other athletes come out within the last 2-3 years saying pressure is there and it gets us. But I don't mind actually when people come to me and they're like, oh, are you Lauren Stebbins? And I'm like, are they going to know me right now from my sporting endeavors or are they going to know me from being on Strictly?
Do you care? Do you think I
think people expect me to be a bit like, well, why don't you know me for my sporting endeavors? Because that's what I've worked my whole life for. But actually, I see Strictly pretty much equal to being a Paralympian, because it is such a great machine. And to get to the semi-finals of Strictly is so difficult. And I don't think people quite realize, like, it was training 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. every single day. And, you know, I had sore feet. My body hurt so much, sore neck. And then just that Friday going through rehearsals. And it is so big. And I, you know, I was only on SAS for, I think it was 10 days we were put through the brutal course, but it was 15 weeks on Strictly. And, you know, 15 weeks of constantly being on point, learning these things. It was just as hard as training for a Paralympics. Like, everything hurts. So I don't mind. I don't mind what you know me for, as long as I've done my best in anything you've seen me in. To me, I see them as equal achievements.
Yeah, well, I would like to, that's quite interesting, because I'd like to move on now to your relentless drive forward and the endeavors that you're now undertaking, which are both athletic, yet another athletic challenge, and academic. So could you just talk to us a little bit, outline what on earth you're up to now?
Yeah, so I feel as though 30 was a big number to turn last December. And I don't even know why everyone's like, oh, we're turning 30. But in my head, like, I've done 4 Paralympics, Summer Games, and I got that gold medal. And, you know, there's a fire in athletes, and I still have a fire in there. But, like, I feel as though I put a little bit of the fire out, because I achieved that ultimate goal. Like, I have nothing that I need to prove to myself anymore. And so for me, I sat there and I was like, oh, I spent 18 years trying to achieve that one goal. And I got home. It was actually quite surreal because you're in Tokyo and you're getting that gold medal and it's all great. And then, you know, I arrive home and I'm having a barbecue with mum, dad and the sister and she's eating a burger and a sausage in the garden. And it's like, huh, well, what do I do now?
Yeah.
So it's a bit odd.
I can imagine that. I mean, anybody who has that a moment, a high, whatever yeah. it is in their life, then you come back. So you're just back to reality. You're like
sat there with the dog, like, okay. I guess if I hadn't have achieved the goal, you know, you just go straight into that mode again. If I'm not finished, but and I'm not finished because of what I've set myself next. But there was that moment of, am I finished now? Like at 30 years of age, do I want other things in life? You know, holding down a normal relationship would be lovely. Is there the potential of kids, or what does life after sport look like? And I had all those things to go through. And I really thought I was going to retire, really did. And I took that time away because I think I felt ready. And then obviously, you know, it was a lovely summer and I was occasionally on my bike and I was like, oh, but I, you know, I still love that feeling of being in a dark hole, of pushing myself. So maybe I just needed a break to mentally reset. And we can see me back, like Europeans is in 8 weeks and I'll be hitting that. And I'm going to go, at the moment, the plan is to go to Paris, defend that title. Again, don't feel the same as it was leading into Tokyo, just because, you know, I'll give my best and I will turn up and deliver for Great Britain, get everything I can, but there's not that, oh, it's the be all end all, like I have to deliver. So I'm there because I love triathlon and I love being a Paralympian. And then I also did commentary last February at the Beijing Winter Paralympics. I was on the Nordic sports and I saw this thing called cross-country skiing. And I was watching them and I was like, this looks painful. It looks really good fun. And I think I want to have a go. Sat on it for a while, ignored it, because I was like, Lauren, come on now. You've already done four games. Like, maybe it's time. It's Milan 2026 will be the next winter Paranordic event. And I spoke to GB Snow Sports. I think they thought I was a little bit crazy. And they were like, oh, yeah, it will take 6 years. And I was like, I've not got 6 years. Like, my manager's on the call going, no. Should be there in three. And I'm like, I really think, guys, like, I've got the engine from triathlon. Like, it's there, it's built. We just, you know, we need to get skills. And they're like, well, so when was the last time you skied? I was like decade ago, 10 years ago. And they were like, oh, right, okay. So, you know, got me on these roller skis and stuff. And actually, I've taken to it really, really well. I've just spent October through till 3 weeks ago, I was on the snow and a main sport has been cross-country skiing, whether that's roller skiing around Richmond Park or out in Chamonix with my coach Fern. And so far predictions are I will make Milan 2026 and represent Great Britain. Wow. I think I worked out, don't quote me on this, but I'll be the first standing female Nordic to do a summer and a winter. We've had Hope Gordon, who's done obviously in the wheelchair category, but I'll be the first standing to represent obviously a summer and a winter. So triathlon during summer, winter will be cross-country skiing. And there's quite a lot of triathletes that do it actually. So I'm not just an absolute loony bin over here. Like it is actually a thing. so yeah, that's kind of the plan right now, is to keep ticking away. I've switched back into triathlon now to get ready for this season because it's Paris qualification. Maybe lighten up a little bit next winter block on the cross-country skiing, just because I'll need a good solid block leading into Paris. And then after that, it will be full steam ahead. Need to really, it's the downhill. You know, I don't mind going uphill. It's the downhill, going super fast on these really little thin skis. But that's the plan.
I mean, it's a remarkable plan.
I feel like I went from like, I feel like I'm going to retire to actually, I'm going to do two more and going to add an extra sport as well. So now it's swim, bike, run, ski.
I think the, you mustn't do any more commentary, any more events, I don't think, because this sounds like it's a bad influence on you. What are the challenges and the extra demands of cross-country skiing as opposed to triathlon?
I feel as though I haven't quite unlocked the beast in me yet in cross-country skiing, in that, you know, the demands are very similar, you know, huge VO2 max, you know, I'm up at altitude for a start. So like engine-wise, it's endurance. I can go anywhere from between 1.25K up to 15 kilometers. So, you know, you're looking at maybe a 5 minute race all the way through to something that could take like an hour 20. So it's similar-wise, time-wise. Engine-wise, you know, we're training will be similar. It's the intervals, it's the long, intense endurance zones that I'll be building. So in that sense, like, they work hand in hand. It's obviously, well, you say that, but leg-wise, one of the style classic is running. Like, I say it's running style. Obviously, there's a lot more finesse to it than just putting skis on and running. But that is a difficult one to really master, but I can run. So at the same time, I can, if I get to the point I'm slipping, I'll just start running and I can kind of come back. Skating style is a lot more adductors, abductors, and a lot more like glutes than what we'd normally use. So I've been aware of, in the S&C program, slightly shifted to help with any injuries that might come there. So like glutes and legs become really strong. The one that's really got me, and I'm going to have to balance out again, is I only use one pole. So when I'm poling, it's obviously built this shoulder up. And I got in the pool like 3 weeks ago and I was like, what? This side feels a lot, like I didn't have any rotator cuff or any issues this side because it's strong. But this side, I was like, okay, well, right, I've got to work on this now. So that's probably the only discrepancy between what we're doing. So apart from that, they'll work hand in hand. And like at the moment, I've gone into more swim, bike, run stuff, but using the roller skiing as recovery. So let's say I go and do a run session that's super hard. Instead of just doing a 1-2K warm down, I'll do a 45-minute roller ski. You know, it's non-impact, it's no weight bearing. So I'm just going along and I'm getting the recovery I need. So still getting in some of the technique stuff. So yeah, there's kind of a brief summary.
I mean, yeah, it's incredible. I mean, you'll be around Richmond Park then, will you? People can go and spot you.
Yeah, come join me. Yeah.
I mean, because that would be the obvious thing that you would think. It's not only juggling the two and the turnaround as a comparative novice in one sport compared to the other between the end of the Paris cycle and the 2026 Milan. But also, you live in the UK. We're not famed for loads of snow.
Well, neither is New Europe right now.
No, well, this is true. So it's an interesting way to get around it. It's the roller skiing. Yeah. Is there a big community of roller skiers here in the UK?
So the reason I moved to London was because there's a London club and there's also a club in Scotland. And I was like, I'm not going to Scotland.
Well,
like,
you get a bit more snow there as well, I suppose.
I'm not doing it. Oh, I don't want to have some Scottish accent. Like, I quite like my accent. London, there's Hyde Park. There's a huge group who go around Hyde Park. And occasionally when I'm there, you'll see quite a couple of people just, unless we organise a meet, go around Richmond Park. It's, you know, there are cars there, but you need the smooth roads. You know, I could go down to Portsmouth Seafront and just go up and down the seafront if I wanted, but you need the hills.
Like
Brits, because we don't get as much time as the Scandinavians, as the Canadians on the snow, you need to challenge yourself. So trying to get on the snow is obviously the first option. Second to that is find the hills, find the really smooth tarmac that you can get on in the UK. It is a bit more scary on the roller skis because if you stack it on those thin cross-country skis, you're just going to hit the snow. And actually, to be fair, I did cut my face when I went down once last time in Chamonix, but most of the time doesn't hurt. But if you go down on tarmac at like 30 k's an hour on those roller skis, like, it hurts and like skin goes missing. I'm getting over that fear, but I guess it's like being on the bike. Like the best riders going around a corner at speed, they're going to be at an angle and you are always on the brink of, am I going to go over? But that's the fastest line and you're going to learn to take it. So the similarities there, and even just that simple fact of the lines to hold on your skis and stuff, that transfers from cycling. Like, the lines you'd hold on the bike, the same as what you'd hold on the ski. So there's a lot of transference.
You seem to have, with your career so far, have kind of never given yourself a limit on what you can achieve in anything. Is Milan and this aim about getting there, proving you can do this to yourself to get there? Or are you already thinking, I want to get there and I want to compete. I seriously compete at the front end of this.
So we will put me into the world. So I'll be podium athlete next year. We'll put me onto the World Cup races and we will see how I do against the girls. And I'm not going to go in with a naive mindset in that if a girl rocked up to para triathlon and was like, I'm going to take the gold from you in Paris and I've only done this for 50 days so far, I'd be like, oh, sit down, sweetheart. Like, I know, I'm not, you know, I've got however many years of triathlon skills and everything. Like, but at the same time, if that girl come in and she, you know, her intensity, you know, everything was on point, like, she'll get up the ranks. And so I think in my own headset, I'm like, right, let's see if, one, we can get there. I think that's achievable now. Can we get to the top eight? I'd be so incredibly happy with that. Can I deliver? We've got to learn which discipline then and which distance really suits me. And if we focus exceptionally well on that and I give everything I have to it, can I get near the podium? I'm going to say 80%. I think I can. But that's me, everything, the T's, the I's. Like, it's making sure that, yeah. So I'd like to think so. I'll give it my best because it's in me to turn up and deliver what the best exceptional performance I can. But at the same time, I'm aware that this is elite sport and you can't just rock up to a new sport as a development athlete and take a podium. I wouldn't let it happen in my own sport. So I'm not going to, you know, I don't expect to do that in that. But if I deliver a performance that I get everything right, who knows?
And as if all this wasn't enough.
Oh.
I mean, it sounds pretty full schedule already, but you're also, you're already academic. You're already academically successful in your life, as well as everything else, which we haven't really touched on yet. But you're also studying for a PhD as well, just to throw into the mix, to fill up the few seconds that are left in your day.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, why am I doing this? Obviously, I have my own motivations, but, and my dad knows this, but I think it's because I'd love him to have to call me Dr. Lawrence Stedman. Dr. Stedman. Yeah, that's one big thing for me is, I'm going to retire at some point from sport. What's next? And I have done a psychology undergrad and absolutely loved it. Did a business master's, which was okay, but I didn't love studying business as much as I loved the psychology. I said to you, I love helping people. I love, handing people or helping them frame their mindset. So I decided I'd like to do a PhD. And I would like to do this because I think it's my career after sport. Like, I have so much that I can share from everything I've learned with everything else I've done, that then if I am, I'm a doctor in psychology, I can then help others more. An area that I'm really, really passionate about, I think, because at the moment it's like a hot topic, is mental health and mental well-being. Those terms are used interchangeably at the moment. They're very different things. So there's one area I'd like to I guess, sort out in what I'm studying. But also within athletes, I think mental health and well-being is, it's the general population. There's a lot of attention going on right now. As athletes, there's a stigma around, we find it very difficult to admit that, our mental health, or we're struggling, with our mental well-being practices that feed into our mental health. And therefore, can we ask for the help? Can we get the support? Can we put in an infrastructure that helps us to maintain being on the spectrum of being mentally healthy? So for me, I would like to study mental health and well-being practices, I guess, preventative instead of reactive, in Olympians and Paralympians. So we've obviously heard, last year went on a sabbatical. Adam Peaty has just recently said, the pressure is so intense. Simone Biles come out. Lots of athletes. Was it Max Whitlock come out as well? And said, so, these big names are there and just starting to find the strength to say to people, hey, listen, it is a lot. Like, I'm not saying I'm stopping, but can I have some space? So that's kind of happening within a lot of Olympians and Paralympians. So I want to go in and actually work with the athletes. I'm hoping that because I'm a fellow athlete myself, that changes the dynamics. Instead of having somebody that's just an academic interviewing questions, I've been there, I know it, I'm going through it. So let's have an open conversation. PhDs change as you do them. So at the moment, it's just a lot of reading. And, I'm finding out lots of different interesting things. But I think I'm going to focus on the transitional phases, either that's going through being a development athlete to a podium, because that's huge, or whether that's you are going into retirement era now. How do we look at this? How do we help you deal with what might be your last games and then what comes next? Purely because I know that myself, I know the feelings, so how can I help? Fortunate enough, Citibank, huge International Paralympic Committee, they're funding my PhD, so it's really great. I'm working with two supervisors that this is their area. So again, they've got so much knowledge. And I'm undecided. Yeah, I'm doing Paralympians, Olympians, but if I can extend that to high performance, that's military personnel, that's highly corporate, the big winners up there, that it's the same kind of pressures that
it's
come
across.
It's
incredibly transferable.
And that's what I want to do, is I want to make something that actually, even just generally, if you're a high achiever in anything you do, you're going to read my PhD or one of the studies that I do within it and actually be like, gosh, that's really useful. I can use this on my employees, or I can use it in my personal life. Like, I want it to be transferable.
And it's fascinating because you kind of, like you said, you have the, in a way, because of who you are and what you've done and who you know as well, you have the keys to unlock this because you can get these high performance athletes.
Well, I'm just hoping that, and I studied my psychology undergrad was actually on organizational stressors in Paralympians and Olympians. And that was just because not much has been done on, let's just say, for example, Adam Peaty's got his 100 breaststroke in the pool. Okay, he's doing it versus one of the Paralympians that does 100 breaststroke at Paralympics. The logistical things that a Paralympian has to go through, well, will my legs be at the other end of the pool? If they're dealing with any internal issues, like regulation of systems and all of that, that's a different mindset into just going into one race versus Adam just rocking up and being like, boom, just deliver the fastest I can. So my first PhD was on the logistical organizational side of things and the differences, which were huge as well. But Paralympians just, as we discussed earlier, just take it in their stride. You know, they've got the mindset, they deal with it. But I think for me, one of my loose ideas, because you can have all these ideas and it's reading about if it's been done already or if it has been done, what can you do better, is journaling. And it's called written emotional disclosure. And it's an idea that I have had in that could I get 15, 20 Paralympians, Olympians to journal next year leading into Paris? Mm. So start September and give me until probably November the next year because I need that phase just after. Because I mentioned earlier, I sat down and was like, well, what's going on here? But my own coach, Robin Brew, he journaled his journey for swimming into Los Angeles. And it was an incredible journal. Like, I think more people should journal their life anyway, but just the places he went to and the athlete that, you know, he was in that time frame. Reading that, I learned so much about his well-being in that one space and his mental health. Like, it fluctuated. It was never like a, I think people think athletes are tough, so actually we're always like this, a good trajectory going up and we're constantly positive. No, it was more like this than it was this.
And is there a, interestingly, when you look at a journal like that, is there actually a recognition of that? Or are you just picking it out because you can see it so obviously when you stand back, but they can't see it in the moment necessarily?
I think now that he's much older now, he reads it. And for him, it's quite joyous to see the journey that he took. Probably in the moment or a couple of years after, no. Because I don't think as athletes, we stop and even just the smallest thing of an injury, like in that one moment, you are so focused on getting back to the pinnacle of, you know, I need to be race ready for the season, that you do what it takes. You get there. You achieve what you need to and you move on to the next thing. And sometimes when you've had an injury or an accident, say for Paralympians, you're so focused on the rehab and getting to the point you are that it's years later that you reflect on that and you go, oh, wow, well, I've achieved what I needed to now. And all of a sudden you're dealing with a long-term injury or you're dealing with, oh, I did actually lose both legs. Like, so often we are so focused on being present in the moment we don't, but having the journal to reflect on it. I mentioned earlier that I've learned and the experience I've had makes me the athlete I am today. I think if more athletes journaled and did things, one, you have to be open with your coach here, but for example, let's just say I get the journals of 10 athletes next year. I can then say to a coach, right, you know when you pushed your athlete because you thought this needed to be a hard bit? Physically, they probably needed that, but mentally, these were their telltale signs that actually they were on the brink of being pushed too far. They needed a break, or actually perhaps this is the part where they're mentally, these sessions are great, it's boosting them up. For a coach to have that knowledge and insight for how they're then training their athlete is huge.
Yeah, I mean it's an incredible field of study, and we're advancing science both physically and physiologically and psychologically. Yep. So far this sounds like yet another thing that you see that from your point of view is a positive contribution that you can make to not just elite athletes, but society, which sounds like this is the theme that's been recurring during this interview of what's motivated so much of your life to this point.
I definitely think so. And I know that that's just, this PhD is the start of it. To be honest, I see the PhD as just the tick box that's needed as a catalyst for me then being able to go and do the real good work that I want to do. Obviously, researching and studying it will be fascinating. And I hope we'll get some baseline evidence and practices we can do from it. But after that is where it's like, right, well, this is where I've now got the qualification to go and do the things necessary. Maybe that's further research. Maybe that's, you know, being involved, not as an athlete anymore, but as a practitioner and getting, maybe there's a new job role that's coming up that I can fill that actually gets involved. Because I think athletes are an untapped, like, potential. But that being said, the mindset of military people and the mindset of just, I just want to get in there as to what makes people like you've said, me wanting to constantly achieve things. What is it that that is, and can we grab it and can we give it to other people that actually might need a boost or to change other people's lives?
Lauren, it's absolutely fascinating, and it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time to speak to us for so long today, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will find it absolutely fascinating as well. And we wish you the very best with all your endeavors, your many endeavors, and finding enough time in the day to fit them all in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.